As the new president, James A. Garfield, walked through the Baltimore and Potomac train depot, arm in arm with Secretary of State James G. Blaine, an armed man snuck up behind him. Despite the fact that it had only been a decade and a half since Lincoln was assassinated, Garfield had no security detail. He and Blaine were catching a train up north to tour New York and New England with the other members of the cabinet. But as they neared the track, the armed man pulled out his pistol. He'd been stalking the president for months, and as he approached him from behind, he said to himself, "Immortality will shortly be yours." Then he called to Garfield and declared, "This is the hour of your doom." But before the president could respond, the gunman shot him in the back. Garfield turned towards his assailant and made eye contact as the gunman shot him once more. According to the next day's New York Times account, which spanned five columns of print, the president sank to the floor, bleeding profusely from two wounds. The assassin was instantly seized and proved to be Charles J. Guiteau, a half-crazed pettifogging lawyer who has been an unsuccessful applicant for office under the government and had led a precarious existence in several of the large cities of the country. The Times was premature, though not wrong, in calling Guiteau an assassin. Garfield lingered in terrible pain for weeks before he died. Indeed, he likely would have survived if not for the medieval treatments administered by his doctors, which included stuffing their unwashed fingers into his intestine in an effort to retrieve the bullet. Though they weren't able to get the bullet out of him, they did manage to ensure that the president contracted sepsis. After tremendous suffering, the president finally died on September 19th, more than 6 weeks after the shooting. As for the gunman, the Times' description was about right. Guiteau was clearly mad, and he had indeed lived an itinerant and chaotic life. His beef with the president stemmed from Guiteau's fantastical idea that his odd and incoherent freelance campaigning had gotten Garfield elected, and that the president had snubbed him by not appointing him to be ambassador to Paris. Guiteau's trial was held in Washington, D.C., and it was lengthy, with dozens of witnesses. Indeed, the transcript runs 941 dense pages of single-spaced small font. But the facts were not in dispute. Guiteau didn't just admit shooting the president, he was proud of it. Though he did take a swipe at Garfield's physicians. "The doctors killed Garfield," he said. "I just shot him." The heart of the trial, and what made it last so long, was that each side presented over a dozen expert witnesses on one key question. Was Guiteau insane? And in digging into that question, both sides focused on an intriguing period in Guiteau's life. His 6-year stay at the Oneida community. I'm Dan Greenstone, and this is the American Utopia Podcast. Charles J. Guiteau's defense wanted to show the assassin had a long history of mental illness. And because he'd spent so much time at Oneida, they believed that if they could prove life there was unusually cruel and deviant, perhaps the jury would believe that he'd been warped by his experience there. So they took great pains to paint a picture of Oneida as a bizarre and miserable place, ruled by a tyrant. One of the intriguing things about the Guiteau trial is that it does raise fundamental questions about life in the Oneida community. But let's go back first. Charles Guiteau's mother died when he was 7, so he was raised by his father Luther, who was a highly and severely religious man. Luther saw the presence of evil everywhere, and he would literally beat the devil out of his son Charles for any perceived transgression or sin. But in spite of their sometimes difficult relationship, he managed to impart to his son his own great reverence for John Humphrey Noyes's very unusual brand of Christian perfectionism. While Luther Guiteau dreamed of joining Noyes in his utopia, his responsibilities as a single father made that impossible. But when in 1860, his restless and wayward son Charles dropped out of school at the University of Michigan and found his way to Oneida, Luther was delighted. Charles went there with extremely high hopes. He'd been raised on Noyes's massive corpus of writing, and he had been corresponding with the members of the community for months. And through the mail, he made a good impression. He heaped praise on both the community and its leader. In April of 1860, he wrote to the community, "My confidence in you is continuously increasing, and especially in Mr. Noyes. I have perfect, entire, and absolute confidence in him in all things. I believe him to be a man directly inspired by God." By coincidence, this is exactly how Noyes felt about himself. And yet, it didn't work out. For one thing, Charles was a bad worker. One witness said that when he was at the trap factory, he would, quote, "sit for hours in a corner talking to no one." Or instead of working, he would write for hours and then suddenly chuck whatever notes he'd written into the stove. Not surprisingly, John Humphrey Noyes evidently formed a dim opinion of Guiteau. He called him moody, self-conceited, unmanageable, and a great part of the time was not reckoned in the ranks of reliable labor. For his part, Guiteau began to feel that John Humphrey Noyes and the other saints of Oneida were ungrateful. He wrote Noyes a letter in which he complained, "You prayed God to send you help, and he has sent me. Had he not sent me, you may depend upon it, I never should have come. I ask no one to respect me personally, but I do ask them to respect me as an envoy of the true God." Despite his protestations in that letter, though, Guiteau did dream of celebrity and personal honors. Once, a slip of paper fell out of his pocket, and another community member spotted it and picked it up. It read, "Charles J. Guiteau of England, Premier of the British Lion, will lecture this evening at 7 o'clock. Even though he was a novice member in his early 20s, Guiteau saw himself as a peer of Noyes. He believed his destiny was to publish a newspaper, and he wrote to the community arguing that his newspaper idea was, quote, "a splendid chance for someone to do a big thing for God, humanity, and himself. Therefore, I say boldly that I claim inspiration. I claim that I am in the employ of Jesus Christ and company. I know in my heart that I am one with Christ, Paul, and Mr. Noyes." In truth, his ideas, if they could even be called ideas, never struck a chord with any audience. After he'd left Oneida and hung out his shingle as an itinerant preacher, he once managed to drum up a crowd of about 50 people to hear him speak. The price of admission was 50 cents, and the topic of his sermon was, "Is there a hell?" The newspaper reporter assigned to cover the event titled his article, "Is there a hell? 50 deceived people are of the opinion that there ought to be." It's an awesome article. It starts like this. "The man Charles J. Guiteau, if such really is his name, has fraud and imbecility stamped upon his countenance. The evening consisted of the averment that the second coming of Christ occurred in AD 70, interesting readings from the book of Genesis, and the prediction that the world would soon come to an end. Although the impudent scoundrel had talked only 15 minutes, he suddenly perorated brilliantly by thanking the audience for their attention and bidding them good night. Before the astounded 50 recovered from their amazement, or the half-dozen bill collectors who were waiting for an interview with the lecturer had comprehended the situation, the latter had fled from the building and escaped." Okay, so first, Guiteau was constantly in debt and had become quite expert at dodging his creditors. So yeah, some not insubstantial part of his audience of 50 had come because they'd seen his pamphlets and they wanted to try to get him to pay up. More importantly, the thinness of his ideas and the confusion in the way that he talked was his standard operating procedure. As his biographer, Charles Rosenberg, writes, "This was the pattern in all Guiteau's lectures. He shuffled papers, spoke incoherently for a few minutes, then abruptly left the podium and the room. Insofar as the theme could be found in his talks, it was the thesis of John Humphrey Noyes." Such a delusional and narcissistic person was obviously not cut out for mutual criticism, the special system at Oneida in which a panel of people publicly highlighted a person's faults. This was difficult for anyone. In fact, Noyes himself never submitted to it. But it was a special trial for Guiteau. The most common critiques aimed at him singled out his egotism and conceit. And of course, Guiteau's odd demeanor and his wildly grandiose impression of his own talents landed badly with the women of Oneida. In theory, Oneida women were free to reject advances from men that they didn't fancy. In practice, it's probably more accurate to say that they were free to reject advances from men who didn't have much status in the community. Certainly, it was not easy to reject an advance from John Humphrey Noyes. But with Gateau, the women could and did say no. One Oneida member recalled that the women of the commune, quote, did not extend love and confidence toward him. And behind his back, the women of Oneida called him Charles Get Out, as in, please get out of here. And so, despite his great interest in having sex, he barely had any at all at Oneida. Indeed, he lamented that at the commune he was, quote, practically a Shaker. And the Shakers were, of course, entirely celibate. And so Gateau's 5 years at Oneida were not happy ones. Not that he was ever happy. But still, it's weird that he lasted 5 full years there. And it's hard to know why he made it so long. Perhaps the explanation lies in the dates that he resided there. He joined Oneida in June of 1860, 10 months before Fort Sumter. And as we discussed in a previous episode, through a combination of luck and privilege, Oneida men managed to sit out the war entirely and avoid the draft. And since he was in his early 20s throughout the war, Oneida was probably the safest place for Gateau to live in the entire country. He may have been crazy, but it's possible he wasn't entirely stupid. In any case, the commune elders seemed relieved when he decided to go away. And in fact, they kind of paid him to do so. They gave him $50 of books, $100 in clothes, $100 in cash, and a banknote for $800 more. Gateau moved to Hoboken, New Jersey, to pursue his newspaper publishing dreams. But after just 3 months of struggle, he reapplied to the Oneida community. In a letter he wrote them, he prayed that they would recognize his true spirit of humility and repentance, and that I may become a little child and loyally yield myself to the community and be a partaker of its life and love. Amazingly, they let him back in. He didn't stay long this time. After 6 months, he'd had enough. It seems the prospect of more mutual criticism became unbearable to him. And, ungrateful as always, Gateau had no sooner left Oneida for the second time than he decided to sue the community for $9,000, quite a sum in those days, for lost wages that he felt he should have been paid for the work he'd supposedly done at Oneida. Noyes responded to Gateau's attorney by noting that Gateau had signed all sorts of contracts when he arrived, foregoing wages, and moreover, that he'd barely worked at all in the first place when he was there. Furthermore, Gateau was known to have stolen money from previous employers and had contracted a venereal disease from a prostitute. Gateau had hoped that the community would at least offer him a settlement. But when it became clear that they wouldn't, he became terribly upset. He deluged the community with letters whose tone ranged from pathetic to enraged to bitter. In one letter, he said that had he not wasted 6 years at Oneida, I should have had a good law practice and a nice family and other things to match, but now I have neither. In another, he threatened to get the governor of New York to order the community to disband and to confiscate their property. It means war to the teeth, he wrote. Not a newspaper war, not a moral war, but a criminal war for them, and a war of dispersion for their community. Gateau took his scorched earth campaign against Oneida to the press. He explained to any reporter who would listen that, as Charles Rosenberg, Gateau's biographer, put it, the community had been founded not to establish the kingdom of God, but to satisfy Noyes' abnormal sexual instincts. All the girls that were born in the community, Gateau wrote, were forced to cohabit with Noyes at such an early period that it dwarfed them. The result was that most of the Oneida women were small and thin and homely. This was back when thin was an insult. At Noyes' instruction, the community's lawyer sent Gateau a cease and desist order, warning him that he risked prosecution for extortion. At last, this threat seems to have gotten to Gateau, and he decided to move on to other ventures. In fact, he picked up and went to Chicago to work for his brother-in-law's law firm. Meanwhile, his father, Luther, who still greatly admired Noyes, was deeply ashamed. And he wrote to Noyes, explaining that while his son was troubled, he was still devoted to Noyes. I have no ill will toward him, Noyes replied graciously. I regard him as insane, and I prayed for him last night as sincerely as I ever prayed for my own son that is now in a lunatic asylum. Noyes was referring to Victor Noyes, his son via Mary Cragen, not his wife, Harriet Holton. Victor had struggled with mental illness throughout his life and had spent time in an asylum. In any case, with Charles Guiteau now in Illinois, Noyes seems to have considered the matter settled. And indeed, he heard nothing more about Charles Guiteau for a decade and a half, between the time that Guiteau left Oneida permanently in 1866 and the assassination of Garfield in 1881. And so he was appalled to have his long-ago connection to Guiteau resurrected. But if Noyes had all but forgotten Guiteau, as the trial made clear, the reverse was not true. At one point, the prosecutor asked Guiteau about his statement that John Humphrey Noyes should have been hung 20 years ago for his licentiousness. Guiteau responded, "John Humphrey Noyes did me a greater wrong than any other human in the world." Indeed, during the trial, Guiteau seems oddly fixated on Noyes. The prosecutor took Guiteau through a series of past incidents where Guiteau committed a violent act. For example, the time he swung an axe at his sister. And after each act, he asks Guiteau if he had ill will toward the victim. In each case, Guiteau says no. Even President Garfield, who he'd just murdered? No. And at one point, Guiteau seems exasperated, and he tries to clarify, and he says he has no ill will towards anyone. The transcript reads as follows. Question: and no ill will towards John Humphrey Noyes? Answer: I have more ill will towards him than any other human being in the world. Question: I thought you had none towards anybody. Answer: well, I will modify that by saying that if I have any ill will towards anybody, it's toward that man Noyes, because he did more harm than any human being alive on this earth. It seems that Guiteau's feelings of hatred toward Noyes were sincere. As his biographer Charles Rosenberg puts it, having been rebuffed, Guiteau grew increasingly bitter, a bitterness proportionate to his early worship of Noyes. And so the defense's strategy was to show that Oneida had somehow corrupted young Guiteau and made him into a monster. In turn, the prosecution aimed to show that Guiteau was already unhinged by the time he arrived at Oneida. And so prosecutors reached out to Noyes for confirmation of their thesis. By this time, in 1881, the community had been officially disbanded for 3 years, and Noyes was living in exile near Niagara Falls on the other side of the Canadian border. He was failing physically, too. Still, he wrote a letter that was read into the trial record. "I am 70 years old," it began, "and have long been disabled by laryngitis and deafness, so as to be quite unfit for service as a witness. But I can write a little yet, and it is no more than fair, out of the memory of the defunct community, to show that Guiteau's insanity had always consisted of vicious and irresponsible habits. In other words, his wickedness was just as ferocious and versatile when he joined the community as when he shot President Garfield." Noyes went on to call Guiteau a pettifogging plunderer and a lascivious hypocrite. To me, there are a couple of really interesting aspects to the role Noyes played in Guiteau's trial. First, if you can get past Guiteau's hyperbole, his grandiosity, his bitterness, and to be fair, that's a lot to get past. But if you can, his critiques of Noyes are actually pretty on the money. At one point in the trial, Guiteau's lawyer read into the record a letter Guiteau had written as part of his scorched earth campaign against Oneida and Noyes in 1866, right after he left the community for the second time. Here's what he wrote. "The Oneida community is among the most spiritual and social despotisms of the 19th century. And whereas in social matters, they're constantly violating the most sacred laws of God and man, and whereas nightly, innocent girls and innocent young women are sacrificed to an experience easier to imagine than described, and whereas the founder of their delightful system is said to cohabit with his own flesh and blood, and whereas, for the sake of those ruined and oppressed women, and for the good of society at large, said community ought to be cleaned out." You know, some of that's true. And in fact, as we'll see in our episode about the community's breakup, these charges, underage sex, incest, flagrant violations of the laws against adultery. These are exactly the grounds upon which a group of crusading ministers came after Noyes in 1878, and that's why he fled to Canada to avoid arrest. Another criticism Guiteau makes of Noyes is that he basically was a dictator. There's a remarkable moment in the trial transcript, and I had to read it twice to make sure I understood what was being said. In this exchange, Guiteau is on the stand being questioned by his attorney, George Scoville, who also happened to be his brother-in-law. Scoville questioned Guiteau about his experience in the Oneida community, and Guiteau blamed his father, who had been an avid reader and devotee of Noyes' perfectionist theology, for getting him to join the community in the first place. Guiteau told the court, "You have no idea the terrible influence upon a man who believes that his eternal damnation depends upon living in any such place. I felt that if I left the Oneida community, I would be eternally damned, and I stayed there until I got in such a desperate state that it was as bad as if I were in hell anyway, until, as I said before, I thought I would have a respite, and under that influence, I got away from the community." Scoville then asks him, "State a little more fully to the jury what was so oppressive to you in the community there." Answer: "I felt like a slave all the time I was there. I see Mr. Frederick Douglass." Okay, so then in the transcript, in parentheses, it says, "pointing to the gentleman." And I paused here, and I was like, wait, what? He sees Frederick Douglass? Is Frederick Douglass at the trial of Charles Guiteau? Why? And I did some digging, and the answer is yes, Frederick Douglass was there. It turns out that Garfield was really a progressive on race, and he had made appointments of several African Americans to positions, including Frederick Douglass. And African Americans had really high hopes for Garfield. He's like completely forgotten now because his term was so short, and he's in that weird period between Grant and Teddy Roosevelt when like all the presidents seem to be from Ohio and nobody knows anything about them. But it turns out that Garfield was like kind of an amazing guy, completely self-made, really progressive. In fact, here's a little bit of his inaugural speech, which he made just 5 months before Guiteau killed him. "The elevation of the Negro race from slavery to the full rights of citizenship is the most important political change we have known since the adoption of the Constitution of 1787. No thoughtful man can fail to appreciate its beneficent effect upon our institutions and people. It has freed us from the perpetual danger of war and dissolution. It has added immensely to the moral and industrial forces of our people. It has liberated the master as well as the slave from a relation which wronged and enfeebled both. It has surrendered to their own guardianship the manhood of more than 5 million people, and has opened to each one of them a career of freedom and usefulness. It has given new inspiration to the power of self-help in both races by making labor more honorable to the one and more necessary to the other. The influence of this force will grow greater and bear richer fruit with the coming years." Okay, so this all turned out to be wishful thinking. We know that in the period between Garfield's death and really until the 1920s, there's just a resurgence of systematic racism, the Klan, lynchings, and his dreams of a progressive country on race were completely dashed. And it's hard to say what effect, you know, him living would have had. We'll never really know. But suffice it to say, it was a real tragedy that Guiteau killed him. Anyway, back to the trial. So Guiteau had been saying that he felt like a slave all the time at Oneida, and then he saw Frederick Douglass and pointed at him. And then he goes on, "I remember reading his Life in Bondage while there, and I felt just as he felt when he was a slave. Since this affair of the 2nd of July, by which he means the shooting, I have often thought of my feeling when I was with the Oneida community, and compared myself to a slave, as he sets forth in his book. Just as he said, I felt like a slave all the time I was there, bound, hand and foot." So this is just bonkers, right? I mean, my fellow white people, can we please not do this? Can we not compare things to slavery? Things that we've been through? I don't even really want to get into it, except to say that, of course, Guiteau could do something slaves couldn't, which is leave Oneida at any time. In fact, he did leave Oneida, and he actually came back. And then he left again. And you could chalk this up, if you want, to Guiteau quite possibly, almost certainly, being insane. But the thing is, Guiteau was not the first or only person to compare life at Oneida to slavery. Lawrence Foster is a historian at Georgia Tech and an Oneida specialist. I called him to get his take on this issue, and I reached him on vacation, and what he had to say was really interesting, but the sound's just a little crackly.
It's a very interesting combination of greater freedom and greater control in different ways. One of the people who left was quite hostile and angry at noise. He said, "After the strictest observation for 3 weeks at Putney, I am compelled to say that his government is an exhibition of the most absolute specimen of despotism I ever saw. The members are under his control in the most absolute sense. I do not think they feel the right of control over their property, persons, time, their wives, choice, judgment, will, or affection. I heard them express not a solitary opinion in his presence until they heard his first, and then all gave in the same opinion. He treats counsel with contempt and criticism as mutiny and treason, and all such intruders are placed under the ban of the community. And although I say it with pain and regret, yet truth compels me to say that notwithstanding the exalted opinion I have of the privileges and advantages of association, if I can have access to them only through worse than Southern slavery, then I will face isolation with all its evil."
So, yeah, there it is again, slavery comparisons. But if we can put that aside, surely this was hyperbole. And yet, there's no doubt that there were others who felt similarly about Noyes' control over them, even if they would have painted the picture in less bold colors. And there's a second really fascinating thing about Noyes' role in the Guiteau trial, and it's the comparison between the two men. In some ways, they're really kind of amazingly alike. Both had failed to finish college. Both had been struggling lawyers who turned themselves into preachers. Both were narcissists who believed that they had some sort of divine commission from God. And both had great difficulty obeying or respecting any kind of authority. And actually, both seem to suffer from episodes of mental illness. Back in episode 2, we told the story of Noyes' manic period in New York after he'd been kicked out of Yale. In his book, Paradise Now, Chris Jennings describes what happened to Noyes in 1834, and it's pretty alarming. During this period, Noyes' life consisted of restless nocturnal wanderings, hallucinations, and general aggravated mania. His letters of the period, Jennings writes, display a fractured syntax totally out of character for this fluent author. And a year later, Jennings continues, he turned up at his sister Joanna's house in New Haven, looking dreadful and making little sense. His sister described it this way: he would not reason at all, but denounced everything and everybody. He looked haggard and careworn, and I felt positive after he left that he was deranged. And as the story of his breakdown got out, his neighbors kept their distance. They seemed to have entered a combination to avoid conversation with me, Noyes recalled. And he wrote scary, apocalyptic letters to his family. Here's one to his mother. "It is like the time when Jerusalem was approaching its predicted destruction. Wars and rumors of wars, famines, pestilences, earthquakes, signs in the sun, moon, and stars, universal commotion, and universal expectation seem to characterize the aspect of the moral world. Amidst it all, for me, I have no fears. Do your hearts fail? I tell you, another coming of the Son of Man is at hand." And then in 1835, Noyes began to claim that his suffering was on behalf of the whole world and that he was immortal. So, yeah, there are some similarities in the personality and makeup of these two men. And in retrospect, what's fascinating is how successful Noyes wound up being, whereas, with the big exception of the fact that Guiteau successfully assassinated President Garfield, in every other way he was a complete failure throughout his life. And that's where the differences between the two men really come in. So, first of all, Noyes was incredibly intelligent. As we've discussed in other episodes, he was a truly excellent writer and a deep and original thinker. And it's hard to overstate how important this was to the success he had at Oneida. It was Noyes' writings that attracted the bulk of Oneida's recruits and supporters, including both Luther Guiteau and Mary Cragin, as well as countless others. In comparison, Guiteau was really not a thinker or writer at all, and he certainly wasn't original. In fact, there's a fascinating portion of his trial where the prosecutor reads passage after passage from Guiteau's writings, and then shows that each one was lifted from Noyes' newspaper, which was called the Berean. And the word-for-word plagiarism is so clear and so obvious that Guiteau is reduced to defending himself like this. The idea of that particular paragraph came from the Berean, and I transposed the sentences so that you would hardly recognize them. I worked over the entire paragraph. I think I improved it, too. Guiteau then notes that he'd purposely not included one of Noyes' sentences in his version of that paragraph. I left that all out, Guiteau says. It improved the idea. And then, at one point, he defends himself against the idea that he copied Noyes by saying, I did put in some kind of comma. Noyes was also an extremely sensitive and perceptive observer of society, and also of individual people. And these were crucial skills, both in helping him flesh out his vision of what his utopia should look like, but also in persuading or manipulating people into helping him bring it to life. In contrast, Guiteau had terrible trouble reading people and almost always made a bad first impression. And there's one more trait about Noyes that I find quite striking. Clearly, he was a visionary, and normally such people tend to be pretty inflexible, I suppose because they believe they have some sort of special commission from God. And that just wasn't true with Noyes. He was actually quite pragmatic. He knew when to fight and when to retreat. This was how he saved the community in its earliest days when the authorities in Vermont were closing in on him. And he also solicited input from others and showed an ability to compromise or change his mind when it was wise to do so. Just to give one example, it wasn't his idea to switch from horticulture to animal traps, but he allowed himself to be convinced that this was the right move. It's a good quality in a leader, and a very rare one in a religious utopia, and perhaps it helps explain why Oneida lasted so long. As for Guiteau, well, he neither listened nor compromised well. And you can get a sense of that from his behavior during the trial. I'm actually going to read from the Wikipedia article about how he conducted himself. It's really interesting. Guiteau frequently cursed and insulted the judge, most of the witnesses, the prosecution, and even his defense team, as well as formatting his testimony in epic poems, which he recited at length, and soliciting legal advice from random spectators in the audience via past notes. He dictated an autobiography to the New York Herald, ending it with a personal ad for a, quote, nice Christian lady under 30 years of age. He was oblivious to the American public's hatred of him, even after he was almost assassinated twice himself. He frequently smiled and waved at spectators and reporters in and out of the courtroom. Guiteau attempted to convince President Chester A. Arthur to set him free through a letter, as he had just increased Arthur's salary by making him president. To the end, Guiteau was making plans to start a lecture tour after his perceived imminent release and to run for president himself in 1884. He was found guilty on January 25, 1882. After the guilty verdict was read, Guiteau stepped forward, despite his lawyer's efforts to tell him to be quiet, and yelled at the jury, saying, "You are all low, consummate jackasses." Guiteau appealed his conviction, but his appeal was rejected, and he was hanged on June 30, 1882, in the District of Columbia. While being led to his execution, Guiteau was said to have continued to smile and wave at spectators and reporters. He notoriously danced his way to the gallows and shook hands with the executioner. On the scaffold, as a last request, he recited a poem called "I Am Going to the Lordy," which he had written during his incarceration. He had originally requested an orchestra to play as he sang his poem, but this request was denied. After he finished reading his poem, a black hood was placed over the smiling Guiteau's head, and moments later, the gallows trap door was sprung, the rope breaking his neck instantly with the fall. Interesting, right? Go Wikipedia! A couple other notes about the Guiteau case. His family was too poor to pay for a funeral, so he was autopsied and buried at the jail. And the autopsy found that Guiteau had a condition called phimosis, which is when the foreskin doesn't retract properly. I'd have more to say about that, but A, I'm Jewish, so I don't really get it. And B, when you click on the Wikipedia link to the page for phimosis, you get a kind of unsettling picture. I took a look and I closed my tab immediately. Bless you, Wikipedia. Secondly, the trial was such a sensation that people began buying relics and souvenirs from it, including pieces of the hanging rope. And rumors circulated that the guards were going to dig up Guiteau's body and sell that too, perhaps especially that tricky foreskin. So, believe it or not, they decided to exhume his body, and they sent it to the National Museum of Health and Medicine. The museum preserved Guiteau's brain, and it's now on display in a museum in Philadelphia. Okay, so that's sort of our little interlude about Guiteau and Noyes, the assassin and the saint. And I think we'll conclude by noting that part of the appeal of Oneida for Charles J. Guiteau was the commune's promise that the people who lived there shared everything, including love. But in truth, sharing love is really, really hard. That's next time on American Utopia.